Good morning, Your Honor.
May I proceed?
The issue in this case is, was the trial court correct in holding that the Endangered Species Act, not the Forest Service's breach, was the legal cause of Scott's damages? It was not. Based both upon the statute and the previous rulings of this court. As this court is aware, when a new species is properly listed as threatened pursuant to the ESA, and there's some question as to whether the marble murrelet is properly listed, that act imposes certain responsibilities and limitations on the government's continuing to authorize activities that cannot be conducted without such authorization. Prime example, of course, is harvesting the timber on these timber sites.
So you agree then that if the government hadn't improperly suspended this contract, it would have been compelled by the Endangered Species Act to cancel it?
It would have been compelled by the Endangered Species Act to do something, Your Honor, that could have been a modification or a cancellation.
Yes. What kind of modification?
You could have modified the contract to provide timber from outside the sale area, for example. The court in Scott Ford...
But it would have been obligated not to permit the harvesting of timber in this area.
Yes. Right. Yes. The listing of the murrelet and the obligations flowing from that.
If they were obligated to cancel or modify, they had the right under the contract to cancel or modify.
They did.
And they would have been compelled to do that, and you wouldn't have been able to harvest the timber. So we would have been expectancy damage.
We would have been compensated for it, of course, Your Honor.
Well, you would have been compensated under the cancellation clause for your expenses, right?
That's right.
Right. So haven't you recovered those? Haven't you recovered your expenses?
Absolutely not. I'm sorry, Your Honor. We have recovered some out-of-pocket costs, yes.
Well, I didn't realize there was any issue on appeal about out-of-pocket costs.
No, we have been paid that.
Yeah. So you've been paid everything you would have received if the contract had been canceled.
If the contract had been canceled, but the contract was not canceled.
Well, I understand. But the answer is that you did receive all the compensation.
That assumes the validity.
Wait. You did receive all the compensation to which you would have been entitled under the cancellation clause of the contract.
That assumes the validity of that clause, which we would not agree with, Your Honor.
The validity of the clause?
The cancellation clause.
What's invalid about
it? Because we believe that it violates the regulation. That the Forest Service is not allowed to limit their liability for cancellation by virtue of regulation.
Is that issue briefed on appeal?
No, Your Honor, that was not an issue in the case because cancellation did not occur. This was a suspension case. The listing of the murrelet and the obligations flowing from it, as this court said, were events that induced the Forest Service to choose to suspend the contractor's performance. The only act of government that caused Scott to experience delay was the Forest Service's order to suspend. This court said that at 1367 of Scott 4. It further said that the listing of the murrelet was not an intervening act that itself directly prevented Scott from performing. These findings notwithstanding, the trial court nevertheless concluded that the ESA was the legal cause of Scott's damages. This erroneous conclusion appears to have been based on the trial court's inability to sort out the way in which the ESA applies. First, to activities that still require government authorization, such as the issuance of a permit or here, the authorization to enter the sale area and to cut the timber.
Talk to me about Section 7A of the Endangered Species Act. It says very clearly there that an agency is not to allow any endangerment of a habitat.
It's not to continue to authorize the performance of activities.
Sure, that
endangered.
Any action authorized, funded, carried out is not going to jeopardize the habitat.
That's correct.
Any action. Now, this contract would conceivably jeopardize the habitat.
They made that
cut down their houses.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, how do we get around the language of this clause, which says the agency really could not have proceeded with the contract?
This court already dealt with that and said, yes, that's what the statute said, and therefore they decided to take an action of suspending the contracts, and that was a breach of contract. This court's already said that.
But the court said that they could have canceled, right?
court said that suspending the contracts was a breach of contract. Yes, they could have canceled.
They could have canceled.
They could have modified the contract.
The problem was that if they had proceeded properly by canceling instead of suspending, they would have been liable for the out-of-pocket expenses.
I'm not sure that proceeding properly would have been the term. Your Honor said that properly. I think they were very concerned at the time that by canceling the contract, they had huge exposure on these 111 contracts and therefore chose not to cancel.
But the exposure under the contract was for the out-of-pocket expenses.
They believed, as I do, that contract does not limit its liability, the government's liability, only to out-of-pocket costs. They certainly believed that at the time. Yes.
What else would there be?
Lost profits.
How can you read the contract as allowing lost profits in the event of a cancellation?
Because, Your Honor, that clause violates the regulations under which the forfeitures proceed. That is, the regulations state that in the event
so
of a cancellation...
So you agree that the contract on its face bars expectancy damages, but you're saying...
Well, yes, Your Honor.
That to the extent that it does that, it's invalid.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct. And that was a key thought in the forfeitures process. Because you see that the Forest Service never took any action to cancel these contracts, nor these 14, nor the other 100 contracts that are covered by this action. Not in this case, but they similarly were suspended.
Mr. Saltman, are you saying then that because it was suspended instead of canceled, under the cancellation provision that they had a right to cancel, only out-of-pocket expenses would have been paid?
As written, they would have only been paid out-of-pocket expenses. We do not believe that that clause validly limits the right to just out-of-pocket. That is not an issue in this case because there never was a cancellation. That's why it was not brief. If your honors feel that that's important, I would ask for leave to file some additional memoranda just to indicate, to clarify that for you. However superficially plausible the trial court's view may have been, its holding is nevertheless erroneous because the ESA could only halt actions for which Scott was authorized. When the suspension occurred, Scott was no longer authorized to get on the land. Therefore, it could not cut down any trees, it could not commit any timber under 7D.
But even if you were authorized, they had to halt these.
They could not authorize, Your Honor.
That's correct.
That's correct.
They cannot do anything that jeopardizes the continued
existence.
So isn't the trial court correct that it's the Endangered Species Act that is your problem, not the contract?
No. Your Honor, they had multiple things that they could do. As we talked about, modification, cancellation, they chose suspension. As this court found, suspension was a breach. That suspension took away our right to be on the land. We could do no violations of the Endangered Species Act because being on that land would make us a trespasser.
But the problem is that if they proceeded the way they should have and canceled, you would have been entitled to out-of-pocket expenses, and you agree that you've gotten the out-of-pocket expenses.
I don't mean to argue with Your Honor, but if they had canceled, which they didn't do, we still would have sued for our lost profits because we say that the clause 9.51 would have been invalid. And as I said, if Your Honor is hung up on that point, I would ask leave to file a memorandum to explain our position. As I said, we couldn't have gone on the land once they suspended us. We would have been in breach. I'm sorry, we would have been criminally trespassing. And removing any timber, of course, would have been a violation of prohibition set forth in 36 CFR 261.6, the unauthorized removal of federal property.
Mr. Saltman, as an aside, the CFC entered a Rule 54B judgment on count 16. I noticed there were counts 12, 13, and 14 filed somewhere, somehow, and they seem to have vanished in the Neverland. What happened to those counts?
If I recall 12, 13, and 14, those were the subject of our motion for summary judgment. Two of them involved non-C601 contracts, and the court granted our motion with regard to those. With regard to the third count, I think it would be the count 15, if I'm not mistaken, that was a C601 contract, and the court treated that in the way that it treated all of the other C601 contracts. Basically, they're assuming even that there was a breach, that he found that there was no causation of damages.
Are those counts still pending?
No. No, they've all been resolved.
All been resolved.
They've incorporated into the appeal before Your Honor. I want to talk briefly about the government's primary argument that in this case that may avoid liability for the breach by retroactively terminating, Your Honor. Such a rule does not, however, exist even with regard to standard procurement terminations of convenience clauses, let alone with regard to conditional clauses such as the one present here. As this court has held with regard to standard termination for convenience clauses, constructive termination is applied when the basis upon which the contract was actually terminated is legally inadequate to justify the action. That was the maximum case. The government here does not seek a constructive termination.
One other question.
Sure.
Scott Timber proceeded as an applicant.
It did.
Doesn't that mean that you agreed not to log two?
Oh, no, it doesn't, Your Honor. What it does do is...
Well, an applicant under that same section, Section D in this case, has to make no irreversible or irretrievable commitment of resources. They have to avoid the damage.
Okay.
So didn't you agree?
No, I think what the applicant situation indicates is, first of all, that we needed the Forest Service's permission to continue performance. An applicant is someone who needs that approval. Therefore, again, it shows that we could not have gone out onto the land and done anything, including cutting the trees. Moreover, that timber that is in question did not belong to Scott Timber. It could not commit that resource. At all times, title to that was in the Forest Service, and we could only cut that with their permission. They withdrew that permission when the suspension occurred. Therefore, we could not have committed that resource in violation of Section 17. I see that I'm getting into my rebuttal time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Salton. Mr. Grove.
May it please the Court. This Court should affirm the judgment of the United States Court of Federal Claims, which having entered judgment for Scott for others of its expenses, held that Scott was not entitled to cover what we've characterized as breach expectancy damages, that is, the expected profit that it would have earned. Now, Scott today has characterized the issue as whether the Forest Service and not the Endangered Species Act was the cause of Scott's damages. And indeed, the trial court characterized the issue in the same manner. We don't believe that to be the proper question for the court to decide.
Is Mr. Saltman correct that you had alternative ways of dealing with this once the problem arose in the Endangered Species Act?
That's absolutely incorrect, Your Honor. And I was pointing at addressing that. Most of the units were eventually determined to be occupied. And the alternative available to the government in this case, without sufficient knowledge of the status of the individual sale units, was either to temporarily delay harvesting. One of the options that Scott has argued below was, well, the government should have engaged Scott in negotiations and asked for a voluntary suspension of operations. Absent that, the only alternative available for the government was to cancel these sales. And indeed, Scott, in its brief to this court, and at its reply brief, dated January 8, 2003, at page 9, specifically acknowledged the fact that the government had the contractual authority to terminate. Scott made exactly the same argument below to the Court of Federal Claims, which was adopted in the Court of Federal Claims decision, and that's brief of Appellant Scott Timber Company, September 30th, 2002, at page 11. The reply brief excerpt that I've referenced is at page 9, and this court, in its decision, at 333 Fed 3rd at page 1367 specifically held that the Forest Service had contractual authority to suspend.
We're not just dealing with an authority question. It was obligated by the Endangered Species Act either to take some action that would have stopped the logging.
Under this,
it took an improper action of suspending it, but if it didn't suspend, it was obligated to cancel, right?
That's absolutely correct. Given this court's reading of the fact that the Forest Service had no authority to temporarily suspend, the only option that was present to the Forest Service in this case was to cancel. And as we pointed out in our brief, one of the options considered during the environmental deliberations in which Scott was an applicant was, in fact, the option, if you would, of canceling the scales. And Scott, in its capacity as an applicant, specifically argued against that option. So here the government had the right to take this certain action, which Scott concedes would have eliminated any breach damages. Scott argued against that. And Scott's position now that the government lacked that contractual authority is directly inconsistent with the position Scott took before the Court of Federal Claims, before this court in its reply brief, in the first appeal of this matter, at page 9, where Scott stated, let me quote this, C6205 provided the Forest Service with authority to cancel or modify the contracts to comply with the easement. As I understand the comments now, that's in direct contradiction to an argument that was presented in this court in the first appeal of this instance. And indeed, this court expressly adopted that reading of C6 2.5 at page 367 of its initial decision. Scott has identified the issue in this appeal, and I think this characterization is important, as whether the Forest Service, not the Endangered Species Act, caused Scott's damages. That was not the argument the government presented in its motion for summary judgment below. The government, in its motion for summary judgment below, argued that Scott could not meet its burden to prove breach expectancy damages. And that question has been addressed numerous times by various panels of this court, but ultimately I think the broad outline has to be consistent with the Supreme Court's resolution of this question, as that the resolution is set forth in the decisions of both College Point Boat and Penn Foundry. In College Point Boat, the Supreme Court considered the situation that existed when the president had the authority to cancel a contract. And the court articulated the rule that where the government has the right to cancel a contract, the party is not entitled to breach expectancy damages. This in no way is inconsistent with general notions of contract expectations, because the party is, of course, constructively aware of the statutes and the regulations. And where the government has the right to cancel a contract, a party has no reasonable expectation that it would be entitled to breach expectancy damages if circumstances arise such that the government is required to cancel the contract.
But if it unilaterally suspends, does that mean that they would be looking to alternative resolutions of the problem rather than termination?
That's exactly what happened to you, Your Honor. And Congress stepped in. We disagree completely with Scott's characterization that the government had the statutory and regulatory authority to provide substituted timber.
Okay.
That issue wasn't addressed below. And we think that under the terms of the under various Forest Service statutes and regulations, in order to put a new section for sale, special authority would be required. What happened in this case, given the magnitude of the suspension of the logging, Congress stepped in and provided just such authority, and that is the Rescissions Act. So the Forest Service in this case received specific statutory authority to provide replacement timber, different timber, unadvertised timber, but under the Rescissions Act, the Forest Service had the authority to provide that timber as a replacement to avoid the problem that occurred in this case, when because of the provisions of the Endangered Species Act, the Forest Service was not permitted to allow Scott to go ahead with harvest.
Was that authority issued after the suspension in most of these contracts?
Yes, it was, Your Honor, and it was in specific response to the suspension. They called this a crisis in the Northwest, given the magnitude of the suspension of the logging. Congress, appreciating both the significance, the economic significance to the lumber companies and the communities who would be deprived income, stepped in and gave the Forest Service authority that authority that they previously lacked, and that authority was to provide substitute replacement timber for the contracts in this case.
I don't understand. If the Forest Service could supply replacement timber, why wasn't it obligated to do that?
Well, because they had no authority to do that until the Rescissions Act was passed.
When was that?
That was passed well after the suspensions in this case, I believe 1995. So after the suspensions were in place.
What was the duration of the contract?
The contracts in this case have actually been kept open. Several of them, most of the contracts in this case are still open. And that is because Scott is receiving replacement timber under the provisions of the Rescissions Act. So the contracts, as vehicles to allow that to occur, the contracts in this case, the majority of the contracts are still open. Some of them have been closed.
Is there any contention by Scott that they should get more replacement timber than they're getting?
There have been disputes with regards to the replacement timber that's been made available. There was a settlement agreement with regards to the actions brought under the Rescissions Act, which provided that Scott's entitlement to any relief in this action is separate and apart from the Rescissions Act.
So did they have a claim under the Rescissions Act that they didn't get what they were entitled to?
They have asserted such claims, and such claims have been resolved. There's no litigation or administrative claim pending at this point in time based upon my latest inquiries. Okay. Scott's also advanced an argument that there's some question as to the validity of the provisions of contractual provisions which limited liability. The Court of Federal Claims in Reservation Ranch specifically upheld the validity of the C9.52 provision and rejected such an argument. So if there is authority that no such remedy is available. And let me turn back to what I think is the real gravamen of the case. And the gravamen of the case is where you start your analysis. And I think the proper place to start the analysis in this case is what is a plaintiff's duty to prove its entitlement to damages? That's the question the court addressed in College Point Boat. That's the question the Supreme Court addressed in Penn Foundry. In both College Point Boat and Penn Foundry, the Supreme Court found that the plaintiff failed to meet its burden. In College Point Boat, it was because the president had the ultimate authority to terminate the contracts. The trial court below rejected application upon the basis of its reading and the reading of a Board of Contract Appeals decision that in College Point Boat, the Supreme Court held that this authority, or this principle, only applied in cases where the government had what the court characterized as an unconditional right to termination. That is not the holding of College Point Boat. The Supreme Court in College Point Boat mentioned the fact that there was unconditional authority to suspend, but the Supreme Court specifically set forth a rule of law as to which cases a plaintiff would have no right to recover breach expectancy damages. That statement of law does not include any requirement that the right to terminate be unconditional. And indeed, any such holding is inconsistent with the long line of cases in which the Court of Claims applied College Point Boat. Even where the contracting officer has to make a determination, the Court of Federal Claims held, that the principles of College Point Boat may serve to bar a claim for breach expectancy damages. Penn Foundry, I think, is important as well to the extent that it addresses a contractor's burden to prove entitlement to damages. In Penn Foundry, the situation existed that the contractor couldn't meet the contractually required schedule for delivery. And that appears to be undisputed. He would have had to go to the government and seek authority. The Supreme Court in Penn Foundry held that there was no entitlement to breach expectancy damages because there was no guarantee that the government would grant such authority, and under these circumstances, a contractor could not meet its burden of proving entitlement to breach expectancy damages. The Court of Federal Claims, the seminal case of the Court of Federal Claims involving a contractor's burden to prove entitlement to breach expectancy damages, is Murley versus United States. I recognize that there's been some tension in reading that decision in recent decisions in this case. Scott relies extensively upon a panel decision of this court in Citizen Federal. Now, Citizen Federal has no proper application here for several reasons. One, in Citizens Federal, a panel of this court held that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in applying a substantial factor test in determining entitlement to breach expectancy damages. In examination of the decision here below, and I'm referring to the appendix to Scott's brief, page footnote 2 of the court's opinion. In that, in footnote 2 of the court's opinion, the court specifically considered Scott's entitlement under a substantial factor test and held that it made no difference as to what standard was applied, that whether you applied a substantial factor or a but-for analysis, Scott still was not entitled to breach expectancy damages. Thus, Citizens Federal has no proper application in this case because the trial court specifically considered it. Citizens Federal, moreover, held that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in applying a substantial factor test. Here, and in no way suggests that the application of a but-for analysis in a case such as this would be improper. Citizens Federal provides no support whatsoever for an argument that the trial court provided the incorrect standard here. Let me turn to the question of the proper application of the impact of the Endangered Species Act in this case. As an applicant, Scott couldn't make a binding commitment of resources. And what that does is prevents people that are involved in the administrative process from changing the equation that might be made in deriving various environmental situations. Cutting down the trees is the ultimate commitment of resources in this case. Scott's contention that it could have gone ahead and harvested and earned these breach expectancy damages flies in the face of Scott's commitment as an applicant under the Endangered Species Act. Consistent with Scott's the legal responsibilities that Scott had as an applicant under the Endangered Species Act, Scott cannot meet its burden to prove an entitlement to breach expectancy damages, especially under Penn Foundry and under College Point Bow. This court can, but need not, turn to its own precedent in this regard, because the precedent of the Supreme Court, I think, definitively establishes that under the facts of this case, Scott cannot recover its entitlement to breach expectancy damages. For the reasons set forth both in the trial court's opinion, our brief, and that I've set forth today, this court should affirm the decision of the trial court, which dismissed Scott's claim for breach expectancy damages, but allowed Scott other relief in accordance with the terms of the contract.
Mr. Brooks, you have a little over 2 minutes remaining. If we're getting replacement timber under the Rescission Act, where's the problem?
The timber came about 12 years after the breach. There was a period of time when our client did not have timber to run through its mills. That's where the rub is, Your Honor. There were times when our client was running its mills at less than the capacity that it should have because of the suspension.
And for that, you got cancellation costs, right?
We got some out-of-pocket costs. We did not get
all the out-of-pocket costs that you claim.
I'm sorry?
You got all the out-of-pocket costs.
We got all the out-of-pocket costs that were available under the contract. We were not made whole, however, Your Honor.
But there's no issue about out-of-pocket costs on this appeal.
No, there isn't.
It's all profit, right?
It's all return of cost. It's not profit at all. We got no profit. None. Not a penny.
What do you mean? I thought the claim here was to expectancy damages.
Yes, we are. You're saying what we got paid. We got
not what you got paid. There is no issue on this appeal. You are not claiming additional costs on this appeal. It's all profit that you're claiming.
That's not necessarily true, Your Honor. We are asking for unabsorbed costs as well. If we get remanded back for damages, that's what we will put on the table. Our expectancy plus the cost that we did not get, such as unamortized mill costs for running at lower than capacity. The regulations, contrary to what Mr. Grote told you, the regulations did allow for the agency to provide Scott timber from outside the sale area. The secretary could approve that. Yes, they could have canceled if certain findings were made. But they would have had to have paid us damages. As a matter of fact, at the very time of these cancellations, the Forest Service was paying replacement costs in one of the regions of the Forest Service, so that we would have gotten if they had followed what they were doing elsewhere, they would have paid us in excess of what they did, what they would have paid under that C9.51 clause. I think that what is important also to realize is that Judge Margolis found that while the listing of the species was foreseeable, that the listing was a sovereign act, it was also foreseeable, therefore, the suspension was not a sovereign act, and as this court found, it was a breach.
Mr. Saltman, I think
yes. Your time has expired. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Our next case will be Janity versus the Department of Veterans Administration.